Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, our mission is to get under the hood of a really fundamental piece of legislation, the UK's Protection from Harassment Act, 1997. And we're going right to its absolute core, Section 1.
It really is the foundational rock of the whole act. We're looking at a very powerful tool designed to combat that kind of repeated escalating misconduct.
And it was brought in for a specific reason.
Oh, absolutely. It was designed to tackle harassment, stalking, intimidation, really any pattern of behavior that causes fear, alarm, or, you know, serious distress.
And it's not just an idea on paper. It has real teeth.
Precisely. The power of this act, I think, lies in its dual application. If you're a victim, you have two routes you can take.
Okay.
First, there are criminal defenses. This means the police can get involved, charge the perpetrator, and that can lead to fines or even prison time.
And the second route?
That would be the civil remedies. This allows victims to claim financial damages and, maybe most importantly, apply for an injunction to legally force the behavior to stop immediately.
So you get that immediate protection and then the long-term accountability.
Exactly.
And for you, the listener, we are focusing on Section 1 because it establishes the core rule. You cannot pursue a course of conduct that amounts to harassment. And to prove that in court, you have to satisfy three legal tests.
Three mandatory tests.
Yes.
And if even one of them fails, the whole case just falls apart.
So that's the architecture for today.
That's it. We'll start with the definition of individual harassment, what the law calls Section 1, subsection 1.
Yeah.
It's very clear. A person must not pursue a course of conduct towards one person, which amounts to harassment, and which they know or ought to know is harassment.
Okay, so let's break down that first mandatory requirement. It's often the hardest part to prove in the real world, isn't it? The course of conduct test.
It really is, yeah.
Because I think most people, when they hear harassment, they just think of one single really awful incident.
It's a very common misunderstanding. The law is explicit that harassment is not a single isolated incident. If someone shouts at you once in anger, I mean, that's unpleasant, but it is very unlikely to be harassment under this act.
So what's the minimum then?
To meet the legal definition, the behavior has to happen on at least two separate occasions.
Two. Okay, so that repetition is absolutely key.
Yes. And crucially, those two or more actions have to be connected.
Mm-hmm.
They need to form a clear, identifiable pattern of behavior. The law is targeting the cumulative impact of what someone does, not just a single argument.
Can you give us a modern example of that? I mean, especially with everything happening online now, which can be so chaotic.
Sure. Let's take an online campaign targeting, say, a public figure.
Mm-hmm.
An initial tweet making a harsh comment. That's one incident.
Okay.
But if the same person follows that up a couple of days later with a stream of late night direct messages, and then they post a photo of the victim's house.
Wow.
That repetition, three distinct but connected actions, mm-hmm. immediately satisfies the course of conduct requirement. The common thread is the pursuit of that one person.
I wonder about the timing, though. What if I send one abusive text today, and then 6 months from now I send another one? Is that still a course of conduct, or do they have to be close together?
That's a great question, and that's where the courts have to use their judgment. The law just says two separate occasions.
Right.
But that connection is vital. If there's 6 months between them and they're completely unrelated in topic or context, it might be harder to prove they form a pattern.
But if they are related.
Well, then yes. If the first text was a threat to release some private information,
yeah.
and the second one 6 months later just said, I haven't forgotten, well, the connection is suddenly crystal clear. A court is very likely to see that as a single ongoing pattern of intimidation. It's about the nature of the behavior, not just the dates on the calendar.
Okay, so once we've established that foundation, this pattern, we get to the second question. Does this conduct actually amount to harassment? What kind of harm are we talking about here?
This test is all about the impact. The law covers behavior that is, you know, objectively oppressive and unreasonable.
So things like bullying, intimidation.
Yeah, exactly. Bullying, intimidation, threatening behavior. Functionally, it has to cause alarm, distress, fear, or humiliation. Once you've established the pattern, the next step is asking if that pattern as a whole is severe enough to be called oppressive and unreasonable.
Going back to that online example, the messages, the photo of the house, I mean, that seems like a slam dunk for causing distress and alarm.
Oh, absolutely. That level of intrusion and targeted contact would almost certainly be seen as oppressive, no question.
Which brings us to test three, and this is where I think the rubber really meets the road legally. the know or ought to know requirement, the fault element.
Yes, this connects the action to the perpetrator's state of mind, and it's a dual test.
Dual?
Yes. The subjective part asks, did the perpetrator actually know what they were doing was harassment? For instance, if the victim sent an email saying, stop contacting me, you are harassing me, well, there's your direct proof of actual knowledge.
But that subjective standard must be hard to prove. People can just lie and say, I had no idea.
And that is precisely why the objective standard is so vital. It asks, if the person didn't know, ought they to have known? This is the core protection for the victim. It completely shuts down that common excuse of, oh, I didn't know I was causing harm, or I thought it was just a joke.
Let's dig into that ought to know standard a bit more, because that's in Section 1, Subsection 2. Why is that objective standard so powerful?
Because it shifts the entire focus away from the perpetrator's potentially deluded state of mind. The defendant is judged by the standard of a reasonable person in possession of the same information.
That's a really critical distinction. It's not just some random person on the street.
No, it's a reasonable person placed in the exact same shoes as the defendant.
So if I'm on a jury and I'm judging the person who posted those photos, what information do I give my reasonable person alter ego?
You give them everything, every single piece of information the defendant had. You look at the content of the messages they sent, any warnings the victim gave them, the history between them.
And the victim's reaction, too.
Yes, any witness distress. And then the question becomes, given all of that, would any reasonable person have realized that continuing this behavior amounts to harassment?
It basically sets a common sense bar for how we treat each other. You can't just claim ignorance if all the evidence of the harm you're causing is right there in front of you.
And that is the genius of the objective test. It ensures the victim's right to be free from this kind of distress overrides the perpetrator's claim of, you know, poor judgment.
And all three tests have to be met.
All three. Course of conduct, amount of harassment, and knowledge or ought to know. All of them.
Okay, so if we step back from the individual level for a moment, the law also deals with something more coordinated, right? Section 1, subsection 1A on coercive harassment. That sounds like a different beast altogether.
It is a very different beast. This subsection targets situations where the perpetrator isn't just trying to cause distress. They're trying to force a particular outcome.
So it's about pressure.
Exactly. It often involves conduct against multiple people, usually to pressure a key person or an organization. You see this sometimes with protest movements or commercial disputes that, well, that cross a line.
That sounds like a much higher bar to clear for a prosecutor. What are the specific requirements?
Well, the first two are similar. There has to be a course of conduct, but here it has to be against two or more people.
Two or more, okay.
And second, the perpetrator still has to know, or ought to know, that it amounts to harassment.
So what's the critical third element? What makes it coercive?
It's the intent to unlawfully persuade. This is the extra layer of criminal intent, the mens rea. The whole point of the harassment has to be to force someone to act against their will or their legal rights. That intent is what separates it from just a general campaign of nastiness.
Unlawfully persuade. What does that actually look like in practice? How do you prove that specific intent?
Let's use a landlord example. A developer buys a building, but all the tenants have valid leases.
Right. They have a right to be there.
They do. But the developer wants them out. Now, if that developer starts orchestrating harassment, cutting off the heat to multiple apartments, letting the building fall into disrepair, making loud construction noises at 3 a.m.
The prosecutor would have to prove the underlying goal.
Precisely. The intent isn't just to be disruptive. It's to make the tenants give up their legal right to live there.
It's to coerce them into doing something they don't have to do, which is leave their homes.
Exactly that. Or to stop them from doing something they're entitled to do, like live peacefully.
Yeah.
That explicit goal of manipulation is what elevates it to coercive harassment. It recognizes the power imbalance and the organized nature of the abuse.
That adds a really necessary texture to the law. It's not just about emotional harm, but about protecting people from these coordinated attacks on their rights.
It absolutely does. Yeah. It acknowledges that harassment is often a tool, not just an end in itself.
Okay, so we've defined what harassment is and its two main forms. But now we have to talk about the gray areas. Sometimes actions that are distressing are, well, they're necessary. The law has to have some balance.
It does. Section 1, subsection 3 outlines three specific statutory defenses. If a defendant can prove that their conduct falls under one of these, then the act doesn't apply, even if they cause distress.
And the burden of proof is on the defendant here, which feels important.
It's very important.
So what's the first defense?
The first is exception, A, preventing or detecting crime. This covers situations where the conduct is a necessary part of, say, a legitimate police investigation.
So if the course of conduct is actually surveillance, that's protected.
Correct. Imagine undercover police monitoring a suspected drug dealer for weeks. They're tracking their car, showing up at places they go. That fits the legal definition of a course of conduct, and it's probably causing distress. But its purpose is crime detection. So it's exempt.
The second exception seems even broader. Things required by the system itself.
That's exception B. Under enactment or rule of law. This is for conduct that is mandated by a specific law, a court order, or some other official rule.
Can you give us an example?
A bailiff. If a court issues a warrant of execution for unpaid debt, a bailiff is legally required to go to a property to seize goods. They might have to visit multiple times, a course of conduct causing alarm for sure.
Yeah.
But because the bailiff is acting under the authority of a court order, that action is lawful and protected by this exception.
And finally, we have the most flexible and probably the most debated defense. Exception C, reasonableness.
This is the catch-all. It basically asks the court to decide whether, in the particular circumstances of the case, the course of conduct was just reasonable. It's very fact-dependent. It's designed to make sure the law doesn't stifle legitimate activity just because it causes some minor upset.
The challenge here must be drawing that line between what's reasonable contact and what's aggressive harassment. I'm thinking of something like debt collection.
It is the ultimate balancing act. A debt collection agency has to be allowed to make contact. But if they start calling 20 times a day, threatening family, showing up at your work,
it's clearly crossed a line.
It's crossed into unreasonable conduct. A court will look at the frequency, the proportionality, the tone. If the agency is measured, calls during business hours, and sticks to necessary legal communication, it's likely to be found reasonable. The defense is there to protect proportionate, legitimate activities.
The framework of Section 1 is, well, it's incredibly sophisticated when you lay it all out like that. It's not just a ban on being unpleasant.
Not at all.
It's built on proof of a pattern, proof of impact, and proof of fault. If we were to synthesize everything we've walked through, what's the single most important lesson?
I'd say it's that the law focuses on patterns of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of a course of conduct, not just one incident, no matter how nasty, that's the entire foundation. If the pattern isn't there, this act doesn't apply.
And the test for fault is unforgiving, which is so important for protecting victims. It's that combined subjective and objective test. It looks past what the person claims they knew and judges them by what a reasonable person would have known.
A powerful safeguard against deliberate or reckless ignorance.
And finally, the law is refined enough to distinguish harm based on its purpose. We saw how general harassment is treated differently from coercive harassment, which needs that higher proof of intent to manipulate someone.
The legislation has multiple tiers of severity built right in.
It provides a robust but also a carefully balanced framework for dealing with conflict in modern life.
A complete necessity, I think, given how complex our interactions have become.
And that balance leads us to our final thought for you to consider, which is really about that tension between what's legally necessary and how it feels to an individual. We talked about those lawful exceptions, especially the reasonableness defense. Given that the ought-to-know standard, the reasonable person test, applies to everything, how much distress does an official activity, like lawful surveillance or proportionate debt collection, have to cause before it crosses the line from being reasonable under the Act's defenses into actual unlawful harassment? Where do you think that shifting boundary is in practice?
It's a question of balancing the public good against personal autonomy. And it's a question the courts have to grapple with every single day.
That was the deep dive into Section 1 of the Protection from Harassment Act 1997. We'll see you next time.